You are tuned to Grecian Echoes here on WNTN 1550 AM in Cambridge, Needham, and Boston. We are streaming at WNTN.com. It's Mondays with Mileti and your host, Mileti Pouliopoulos. At this time, I have a very special guest who is joining us by telephone, Dr. Yorgo Topalidis. He holds a PhD in sociology from the Department of Sociology and Criminology in Law at the University of Florida. Yorgo's research interests lie within the field of historical sociology. His dissertation, which received the Modern Greek Studies Association's prestigious John O. Yatridis Best Dissertation Award, proposes the whitening process model as an epistemological framework for understanding the dynamics of social construction, contestation, and social memory of white identity. Yoro's research complements scholarship that decouples whiteness from white supremacy. He is currently preparing a monograph that explores the early 20th century experiences of Ottoman Greek migrant identity construction, contestation, and transgenerational memory transfer in a U.S. context. That's quite a bit to say, but I guess the first thing that we should say, because I know we have him by telephone, is Kalimera, Dr. Topalidis. Kalimera, Yorgo.
Kalimera. Kalimera se esas ke sto akroteriyo mas. Good morning, everybody.
How are you? By the way, I want you to know that the music, the background music, the intro music that we were playing was by Mr. George Makridis from his new CD, Roads West of the City. And I know that you had interviewed him as part of one of your projects. I just wanted you to know that.
I have. Thank you. Yes, George is a great friend. And the CD, I received a copy of it as soon as it came out. Wonderful work done by George.
Yeah, and it's so nice that you got to meet him. And that was many, many years ago, and that was part of the Ottoman Greeks of the United States Digital History Project. I would like to start with that, if we could. Would you tell us a little bit about that project and what some of the goals are?
Yes, absolutely. Well, George was actually the first interviewee of the project back in 2015. And the project was sort of a work in progress from my master's thesis days. I really did not know what to do with the information that I had collected as part of my master's thesis. I had studied migration from the Ottoman Empire to the United States at Southern Connecticut State University, and I had collected all this information from newspaper archives in New York Public Library, and was sort of at a loss as what to do with it. And when I came upon the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program in the Center for Greek Studies at the University of Florida, and reached out to the director at the time, Costas Kaparis, and the director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, Paul Ortiz, they were both very excited about this work and fully supportive of it. And since then, I sort of developed it into what it has become with their help. Now it is an ongoing project at the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, and it seeks to document the experiences of the migrants, really, of Ottoman Greek migrants coming to the United States in the early 20th century, but through the recollections, the memories of their descendants. And in addition to interviewing descendants of those migrants, the project also documents different memorabilia that were brought over from the Ottoman Empire to the United States during those early years of the 20th century, inclusive of three-dimensional and two-dimensional objects, and things like icons, jewelry, documents also related to migration, to their migration, personal diaries, books that they brought over with them from the Ottoman Empire to the United States. And in addition to that, photographs of themselves, their places of origin, sort of their early days in migrating to the U.S. Now, in addition to all of... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to say that in addition to the archive, the Ottoman Greeks of the U.S. Digital History Project's archive, we also are developing a mapping project that is slowly collecting all of the migrant records from the Ellis Island archive, online archive, and mapping the migration patterns of Ottoman Greek migrants to the United States. And that is an ongoing part of the project as well.
The project itself is going to be ongoing, right? It has to be.
That is correct, yes. It's currently at over 50,000 images collected and over 250 interviews. And each year we plan a field work trip to a different part of the country. There's quite a long queue of individuals who are interested in sharing their stories, and we're working diligently to collect them all and make them available to researchers both at the University of Florida and worldwide for research purposes.
This is just wonderful work. And there is a great website for the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. And this particular project, the Ottoman Greeks in the United States Digital History Project, is housed there. Is there an easy way for people to find this, or an easy URL that you can give?
Yes, absolutely. I can provide that to the audience. It's through the University of Florida's digital collections. Just a Google search of that will bring you to the Samuel Proctor Oral History Project's page, and then the Ottoman Greeks of the U.S. Digital History Project will be listed under there. But I could certainly provide an address to you, Maletti, and you can share with the audience also.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And I know that there's a Facebook page, so people that are on Facebook can just search there. And you have been in so many states, Florida, California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Michigan. There was fieldwork in Texas, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, currently Utah, Virginia, Washington. This is just phenomenal. How is your work funded, may I ask?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've received the support of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program in the past. The University of Florida has some funds available for graduate work as well. A major contribution was made by the Asia Minor Historical Association, AMHAS, as it was known. When we did field work in Ohio, that organization was just thrilled to support this work, and it was through their help, through that private donation, that the majority of this work has been done and continues. And at the moment, I'm actually seeking further support, both through publicly available grants and private support as well. So it's through private donations and the possibility of academically oriented grants that the work continues.
And how many of people are currently working on the project? I know that Dr. Denise Matthews had done some work with you. Are there other people that are working with you on this particular project?
Yeah, Denise and I were great friends, and worked very hard on the project in its early years. We actually took some fieldwork trips together, and at the time when I wasn't in grad school yet and sort of freelancing, she and I worked together on formulating the audience and understanding the audience together better. Denise was. She is emeritus faculty from Eastern Connecticut State University, and after that point, I sort of continued the work by myself. Denise retired, and she and I are in communication, but I continued the work myself. And since then, I've had interest from undergraduate students at the University of Florida. We're actually working with the Center for Greek Studies now to develop a plan to use this information in their modern Greek language sequence of classes that they have. We've drafted a proposal with Dr. Chris Kostopoulos there, and we're sort of trying to figure out the details of implementing that program and the usage of the information. But yeah, for the most part, I've been involved in the field work for the majority of the time over the course of the past 4 years, especially. This is a matter of funding, right? So my
yes.
goal has always been to bring students with me to participate in these field work trips. And what I'm hoping to do is in the coming year, certainly in the coming years, to get more students both here at Flagler College, where I'm currently a visiting lecturer, and at the University of Florida, and more involved in conducting these interviews.
Which email should people use if they're able to make a donation to the project to keep it going? Should they be reaching out to the OGUS email or to you personally?
Yeah, that's a great question. That would be a good place to start. Yeah, the project's email, and all donations are sort of directed towards the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, because that is where the project is housed. So contacting that email address will put the individuals in contact with me, and then I can provide directions on how to contact the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. Of course, again, through Google, there's a donation page in the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program that they can access and provide donations that way. In fact, every sort of holiday season, we kick off a fundraising drive at the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. So that's coming via social media channels. We're going to be advertising the opportunities for donations that would aid this project.
Okay, I the email address is ogus0424@gmail.com, and the website, for those of you that have your pencil or pen out, it's ogus.oral.history.ufl.edu, and we'll be giving that out again, and certainly we'll be posting it online together with this interview. It's later on in the day. You mentioned field work. You know, Dr. Topalidis, it's a lot of the average listener probably doesn't know what we're talking about here. They're thinking you're out mowing the lawn. Can you describe? Would you describe what field work is?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So this is the process of visiting the community. The idea is to interview individuals who have this background by visiting their community, meeting with them, and taking the time to learn from their stories and the stories of their ancestors, the migrant generation. Through their recollections, we've learned so much and documented unique stories that, the most part, have not been even used in scholarship. Some of these individuals' stories are I could venture to say would change the way we see migration in the early 20th century. They also complement a lot of the scholarship that's been done for sure. But the process is to interview an individual, sort of get all that documented, and usually the interviews last somewhere between an hour and a half to 2 hours. They're all done by audio, and then we spend about 30 minutes usually documenting any memorabilia they have, and all of that is done digitally, and it's done on site. So nothing is actually removed from the individual. Everyone signs a consent form, of course, so that the information can be utilized, but nothing is removed from them. We just sort of mutually agree through this consent form that it could be used for nonprofit purposes by the university and researchers.
And then you take in, so you conduct the interviews face to face, and will photograph or take images of whatever things they may be presenting, whether they're photographs or documents. But all of this needs to be processed and stored, and that's where the website comes in, and then the sort of work behind the scenes. And when we spoke, we were talking about oral histories that are being done all over the country, but not in a very disciplined way. And you teach a class in oral history, so I consider you to be a wonderful authority on the matter. Transcriptions, they're very important, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. This is, you know, the source really of information that researchers can use to you know, write not only public facing you know, news pieces and op-eds, but specifically journal articles and books that are of academic quality. And you know, transcription is the type of process that, you know, is meticulous and time consuming, but so necessary in having the information available in written format. It's part of the process. It's sort of in the middle of the process, right after the interview is conducted and documented. You know, the next step is transcribing it, getting all that audio on paper in a organized fashion so that it can be used for publication purposes. Thereafter, you know, because of the way that the transcripts are constructed, it could be used for public programming too, such as podcasts or, you know, short or long documentary videos, some of which the Ottoman Greeks of the U.S. Digital History Project has already participated in. So there's on our website a couple of examples of just what can be done with the interviews that have been collected and the images that have been collected. With Dr. Denise Matthews, for example, one of the first projects we engaged in was looking at labor history in the U.S., sort of the ways in which Ottoman Greek migrants entered the labor market in the early 20th century. And we looked at specifically seven different cities and the experience of migrants in those cities. And then more recently, I produced a 12-part short video documentary series regarding migration, experiences of migration from different parts of the overlapping regions of the Ottoman Empire and what is today Turkey to the United States. And we sort of looked at different themes related to those experiences. And again, all of that is available on the website for the general public to access. Like you said, transcription is just this critical component sort of right that sits right in the middle of interviewing individuals and then ultimately getting the material ready for public presentation. And without it, the process would be a lot more difficult to organize and deliver.
So our listening audience, I'm sure now, is getting a deep appreciation for all of the work that you're doing, the depth of your work. But there's also, once you have all this data, you need to analyze it and make something out of it and complement that research, that field work, with the research that, as you mentioned, that you had done in the libraries from into newspapers and other sources. And then you're able to, you know, to write an article or, you know, be able to publish your discoveries. I like so much that you're opening up the information, making it available online, and also packaging some of it as you can in your own work and research. I think if there was a Wikipedia for the word busy, just the word busy, your picture should be there. You're doing so much. It's really phenomenal, and very, very pleased to have you here. If you're just listening, our guest this morning is Dr. Yorgo Topolidis. He holds a PhD in sociology from the Department of Sociology and Criminology and Law at the University of Florida. He teaches, he does research, and he has some very cool projects, and we're so pleased to have him on the line. You know, I was looking at your resume, which is also online, your CV, and marveled how you had started in biology. You have a BS in biology, an MS in microbiology, and then had moved into, you know, history of the humanities and sociology. How was that you made that transition? Is that a typical transition for scholars in your field?
That's a great question. It really isn't. It isn't typical. Really? If anything, the opposite is typical, right? Moving from the humanities or the social sciences into the natural sciences, this project as it developed and my research as it developed has really just been a passion of mine. I identify with the very group that I am studying. You know, this is my background. My grandparents were Ottoman citizens of sort of Greek ethnicity from northeastern Turkey, what is known as Pontus. And in the Greek historiography, yeah. And they were part of sort of the escape, not the exchange of population, but the period right before it, where they had to escape from northeastern Turkey, from Pontus to Greece. And, you know, that stories in my family just resonated with me as a child into my young adult years. And, you know, we every time a documentary would come on, you know, on ET, you know, when we had the Greek television or on radio stations such as yours, Meleti, you know, we would be in the family store and sort of discuss all of these events. And, you know, I never really thought or, you know, considered doing anything with it, but I always was so passionate about it. And I know that a lot of the people that I've spoken to and interviewed share that passion with me, and that's why I identify so strongly with it. And I just, you know, after sort of thinking about it and considering it, I went to a lecture in 2006 at the University of Connecticut's Bevia organization.
Oh, good.
Yes, and while there, this was organized by the Pondian societies in Connecticut, specifically the Pondian Society Pondos in Connecticut. They had brought over Dr. Kostandinos Fotiadis from Greece.
Oh, good.
And yes, and he presented his work on crypto-Christianity in northeastern Turkey, in Pondos. And I was, you know, I stayed after and sort of asked him all these questions. He said to me, you know, you seem pretty passionate about this. He said, maybe you should consider, you know, following a path and you know, studying history and sort of see where it takes you. And he sort of planted the seed, you know, and I started working on my second master's at Southern Connecticut State University. I did that part-time. And then after I completed that work, I freelanced for a while and, you know, ultimately found a home at the University of Florida's sociology department and, you know, was able to develop the project into what it is today with the help of Dr. Ortiz, Ms. Deborah Hendricks, who is there, Ms. Tamara Jenkins. These are, you know, key figures in sort of the work that I've done. Without them, it would not be what it is today.
So together you proposed the project and had it accepted within the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program?
That's correct, yes.
That's just wonderful. Tell me, though, I missed, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so in Greece, actually. I was born in Athens and grew up in Athens. Yeah. I'm actually a first-generation migrant to this country. We moved to Bridgeport, Connecticut when I was a kid, 10 years old, and we lived there for 23 years. And after you know, 5 or 6 snowstorms the year before we decided to move to Florida, that was sort of the impetus for our decision was we've sort of had enough of the snow and the cold and we made a decision to move south. But I also was sort of, like I said, freelancing and looking for a place to develop this project further. And, you know, it was difficult for a while in freelancing, but the University of Florida became its home. And if it wasn't for, like I said, the wonderful people at the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. I should also mention Dr. Gonda Van Steen. She was the one that actually was instrumental in identifying my work and, you know, helping me migrate, no pun intended, to the University of Florida's Center for Greek Studies and sort of guided me into the process of networking in the university. All of those individuals were just so critical in helping me set all of this up. And I've lived in Florida since. So it's going to be 10 years now coming up in just a couple of days that myself and my spouse, Eva Topolitis, and now our daughter, Antonia, we all live here in Tampa. And, you know, without Eva's support either, this would not have been possible, you know, for her to just play such a strong, you know, supportive role and helping me just deal with the ins and outs and the daily, you know, difficulties and challenges of academia and of persevering. Without her, none of this would have been possible.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. You know, and it's nice because you've done a lot of field work all over the country, and you have more field work ahead of you. So I'm sure there are times where, you know, you're gone for days, maybe weeks from home and doing what you need to do for your project. Now tell me what I experience with immigrant studies, at least looking here in New England, that in different parts of New England we had different groups from Greece, or different parts of Greece. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I just tripped over my tongue. Let me pick myself back up. I guess I'm wondering if the Ottoman Greeks, in Somerville, we know that a lot of people came from Alatsita and that area. If you went to, let's say, California, is there a different, are the Greeks from a different part of that area of Asia Minor?
Yes, great. That's a great question. So, through my work, what I've been able to deduce is not only migration coming directly from the Ottoman Empire to different parts of the United States, such as the Alatsatiani that you mentioned, or Alatsatians, I guess, would be the correct word for it in English, but in Somerville. And Somerville was, one of these, hubs, for Alatsatians. They're all coming over from, from the home country to Somerville, and sort of having those connections and kinship networks to know where to go and to know where to settle. So Somerville is a great example of, just a mass migration, and 500 families plus moving from Alatsata to Massachusetts. But then we also have secondary migration where individuals would leave, let's say, Somerville and migrate to California or to other parts of the country and find themselves thereafter and establishing their families and in some cases establishing smaller communities that are reflective of sort of that initial, I guess you could call it a colony, right? I mean, we're talking about 500 families within a decade, 2 decades max, all arriving to the United States at the same time. So another example would be like Fort Worth, Texas, where individuals from Smyrna and other nearby cities, towns, villages migrated there. And in addition to Alatsatians, we could talk about individuals from, let's say, Marmara, the island of Marmara, and
Yes.
sort of the chain, the island chain rather, of Marmara. So not only Marmara, the not only the big island, as it's called, Marmara Island, but the smaller islands such as Kutali, and individuals moving to, for example, New York City, moving to Los Angeles, California, to Spokane, Washington, and Oregon, and establishing, like I said, using these kinship networks to sort of leave Marmara initially, and then move to New York, and either settle in New York or then follow these kinship networks west to Los Angeles, California, to Washington and Oregon, Portland and Spokane, and establish themselves there as well. In the case of Marmara, I've been able to find Marmarini. I've been able to find, with the help of Dr. Jim Demetriou and others,
Oh, yes.
a network of a kinship network that starts in Constantinople at the time, and specifically a network of organizations of Marmarinian organizations, Marmarini organizations, where individuals leave Constantinople, and that organization in Constantinople sort of directs people to New York City, to Los Angeles, to Portland and
Really? Oh,
Spokane,
that's fascinating.
and sort of gives them the knowledge and the information needed for them to make that journey, and also to make the secondary migration journeys from, let's say, New York City westward. So you have both, right? You have Marmarini leaving the island and initially settling in New York and Los Angeles, Portland, Spokane. And then after that initial migration, as more individuals leave and leave Greece too, right? Because there's that secondary migration flow to Greece as well. For example, Neos Marmaras, right, in northern Greece, but other sort of refugee communities in Greece, Leaving there and then being directed by these organizations on, you know, what availability there is for jobs and what availability there is for settling in any of these regions of the United States, and people taking advantage of that information to settle. So that's another way that we see migration occurring. And I think it's important to mention to the audience that this isn't entirely unique, right? There are other migrant groups. Greeks as well, so Greeks from Greece proper, you know, that sort of follow these patterns, but Italians, Jews, come to mind at the moment of sort of participating in the same types of kinship networks to aid migration to the United States from different parts of Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and Southern Europe.
What sort of challenges did the Ottoman Greeks face? Were there challenges by way of housing and just social challenges? What were some of the challenges of the early immigrant community?
That's a wonderful question. Yeah. So, I actually published an article, last year, 2022 that, speaks to, housing discrimination, Portland and Seattle, individuals who were in the local community sort of identified as Turkish or Ottoman or Oriental, quote unquote, in general, were allowed to live in particular communities only as servants, right? So they couldn't settle or purchase land and property in particular communities in Portland and Seattle. And that's an important thing to sort of to know and understand, to contextualize that resettlement experience. It's also important to say that it wasn't anywhere near the same level of discrimination that Latinos and African Americans faced in the same sort of region of the country and in other parts of the country as well. But I think it's also important to state that it did exist, right? And even though it existed at a much lesser degree, it's still important to understand and know, because it's part of the settlement process. And it's really part of our history, right? It's part of the history of the Greek diaspora, of Ottoman Greeks in the United States as a diaspora. I think it's important to understand that these events were real and people were experiencing them. And granted, they weren't, like I said, weren't experiencing them at the same level as African Americans and Latinos, but that discrimination was real nonetheless for them. In addition to housing, prejudice, right? So sort of facing prejudice in the workplace, facing prejudice in public, not only prejudice expressed by the white American population in general, but very often in the interviews, individuals will call out specific ethnic groups that they sort of have memories passed down to them of their ancestors experiencing prejudice. So, for example, the Irish comes up very often, or Italians, or other ethnic groups that they were living adjacent to, and experiencing prejudice from them, being felt to being creating an aura and being categorized as inferior to them is a very common narrative that emerges from the interviews. But in addition, being made to feel inferior by Greeks, being called out as Turks or not Greek enough to participate in sort of the larger Greek community, and this went both ways. I mean, according to what we see in the interviews is that similarly, the Ottoman Greek migrant group would participate in this type of prejudice. So it did go both ways, but. It's interesting that during this time, sort of race is such a dominant form such a dominant construct in identity and understandings of identity during this time, and it sort of resonates to the present. We see it at present happening again, and it's sort of speak at much greater length as to why that is happening. And the ways that it happens over time, and sort of the ways that race emerges and submerges over time as an important identity construct, and how it impacts people, how it impacts people's lives, how it impacts their challenges they face in acquiring jobs or being able to buy a house or send their kids to school, and all of these things emerge in the interviews as part of that settlement process and the experiences that Ottoman Greek migrants face and challenges they face, both, like I said, when interacting with the general white American population and these other ethnic groups, and also Greeks as Greek migrants and the Greek migrants as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've come a long way, but I think we still have some distance to go, because, as you say, you know, some of these challenges still exist today, and certainly with other ethnic groups. Now, your research you've been doing primarily here. Have you done any research in Greece, or is there anything that we can learn, say, from the Center for Asia Minor Studies? Or would there be anything in Greece that might help your project?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. This is some we actually worked on a proposal last year that incorporated a collaboration between the Sam Apocryphal History Program, the project, and also the Center for Asia Minor Studies in Athens, and the University of Macedonia, and trying to create a similar project in northern Greece that would try to document in a similar way as we're doing here, document the experiences of settlement in Greece. Some of this work has already been done in the early 20th century. Researchers from the Center for Asia Minor Studies set out to try to interview individuals and documented a large amount of information of those experiences. But they, from my knowledge of that collection, they mostly focused on experiences of expulsion or the exchange or fleeing massacres and the destruction of those communities, which some scholars, I'd like to point out, position as a genocide. So in addition to sort of the Armenian genocide, this idea of all of these massacres and all of this destruction being positioned as a genocide of the Rum community or the Greek Orthodox community in what is today Turkey, what was then the Ottoman Empire. So there are resources available for sure if researchers aren't interested in sort of that expulsion experience, experiences of expulsion, experiences of transfer. That's definitely at the Center for Asia Minor Studies. And this proposal, like I said, that we drew together is something that we're trying to cultivate further at the University of Florida and here at Flagler College now, where I'm a visiting lecturer, to see in what ways we can enrich students' learning about this time period and get them involved in conducting these interviews and learning from these experiences as well.
This is really brings up another area, another project that I'd like to ask you about in the time we have left, because at the top of the hour where I actually host an Armenian program, and that comes on right at the top of the hour. But before I asked you about the White Anti-Racist Activism Digital History Project, I wanted to just note that you have given a number of presentations. You have spoken, you've been invited, and you have given presentations, a Smyrna of 1922 that you gave, Memory and Erasure of a Greek-Speaking Orthodox Christian Community. It was a public lecture that you held in Florida. Another lecture, 100 years after the catastrophe in Asia Minor. More recently, a Mapping Migration, Learning from the Oral History Project. So you are available to speak, and also you have given conference presentations, panels, and workshops. These are the things you do when you're a scholar at your level, and very, very impressed with your work, Dr. Topolidis, and I want to thank you. We don't get cut off at the, without my saying thank you so much for joining this morning. Because when we went to set up the call, and I said, well, normally we start at 9:15. You said, well, I'm teaching, and can we make it a little later? And so I'm glad it worked out. Please, can you just give us a few words about the White Anti-Racist Activism Digital History Project, and because it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thank you for that question. This is a newer project that I'm now beginning to develop. I actually started it last year. And what this project tries to do, it actually grew out of the Ottoman Greeks of the U.S. Digital History Project. I noticed that, you know, as more and more I interviewed people, they had these experiences of prejudice, discrimination. And in voicing them, I noticed that, you know, many of them were actually involved in social justice activism. Both their parental generation was, and in some cases the migrant generation was. And you know, in reading this scholarship about whiteness, you know, coming to the realization that these are the types of examples that you know, are so crucial and so important for descendants of those migrants who identify as white and can be externally categorized as white in hearing. You know, we need, I think, more role models, more people who we can identify as white externally and self-ascribed white that took these leadership roles recently, in recent times. I mean, there's a lot of work that's done, of course, on historical figures, you know, that had played a major role in social justice activism and in trying to get equality for and play a role in supporting civil rights for African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. But there's so many ways in which white supremacy impacts a variety of identities. And through these interviews that I did initially, I noticed that there's people who, you know, we could speak to who are Greek or Ottoman Greek that played a role in civil rights, in the civil rights movement, in social justice movement
really?
More recently as well.
Oh, that's
great. And it's so important to highlight their contributions, because I believe, and a lot of scholarship agrees with me, that speaks to whiteness and whiteness as an identity and an ideology, that these very people should be our role models. You know, we think of individuals in these interviews that emerged, that partook in the a role in the labor movement, for example, and played a major role in the civil rights movement, and more recently, you know, their descendants participated in the gay rights movement, Black Lives Matter, hashtag Black Lives Matter, and the goal of this project is to emphasize and highlight the stories of these individuals since the 1980s to the present, have played a role as externally categorizable white people in social justice movements. You know, it is the goal of this project to highlight their experiences and to bring them to light for the next generation, because as we see, it is so important in today's world, and it always has been important for white voices and white individuals to stand up and speak up for social justice. So that is the you know, sort of the main goal of this project. And it's an ongoing project as well. Again, at the Samuel Parker Oral History Program is where it is established, and we hope to continue work there, again, bringing in students and conducting interviews and documenting memorabilia. So it's set up in a similar way as the Ottoman Greeks of the U.S. Digital History Project, but with a somewhat a different perspective and goal.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And information is on the website ogus.oral.history.ufl.edu. The email address for the Ottoman Greeks in the U.S. project is ogus0424@gmail.com. Please visit the website. If you're on Facebook, please connect with Dr. Topali. This is Projects. And certainly, if you can help with funding, I'm sure that is always welcome. Dr. Topali, thank you so, so much for speaking with us today. It was very interesting.
Thank you, Melody. Thank you for inviting me. I'd like to thank your audience for this time and space that we shared this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Yorgo Topolidis, and very, very proud of his work. Stay tuned for the Armenian program, the Echoes of Keftime, at the top of the hour. We're going to exit this program with another track from George Makridis' CD. This one's called In the Armenian Quarter, taking us right into the echoes of Kev Time. It's Mondays with Mileti.